welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Ashton Woodley. Joining me today is Sean Tuma. Sean Tuma is an attorney internationally recognized in cybersecurity, incident response, cyber risk management, and data privacy law, areas in which he has practiced for well over two decades. He is a partner and co-chair of the Data Privacy and Cybersecurity Practice Group at Spencer Fane LLP, where he regularly serves as cybersecurity and privacy counsel, advising a wide variety of businesses ranging from small and mid-sized companies to Fortune 100 enterprises across the United States and globally. Sean helps businesses protect their information and protect themselves from their information. While this area of the law has evolved greatly in the decades while Sean has been practicing, he continues to evolve with it as a practitioner representing his clients, academically as an author and instructor, and as an analyst for the national media. In 2016, Sean was selected by the National Law Journal as a cybersecurity law trailblazer and Texas Super Lawyers for the top 100 lawyers in DFW. He is regularly selected for D Magazine's Best Lawyers in Dallas and Texas Super Lawyers. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Ashton. It's a pleasure to be here.
I am so excited to have someone of your caliber joining us today. So, the first question we always ask our guests is how they got to where they are. So, Sean, did you, as a nine-year-old little boy, dream of becoming a cybersecurity lawyer?
Absolutely not. I had no interest in anything of that nature. And it was a very, for those that know me and know my pre-law school years, they're probably shocked that I'm not in jail or, you know, bartending somewhere or something like that. It was a very long journey to maturity for me. And maturity is a theme we'll talk about in cybersecurity as well. But no, I had no desire to be a lawyer at all. And I really and had no desire to do anything with tech or cyber or anything like that. And then when I was in law school in the late 90s, one of my professors assigned me a class to pick a law that was going to, or an issue that was going to be relevant when we graduated, and to start becoming an expert on it and then write a publishable article and do all that kind of stuff. And I picked Y2K. So the year 2000 computer glitch and bug and all of that. And so I was excited because I wrote the article and got offers to publish it, got an offer to speak about it before I even had my law license at a law conference to be the keynote. And this was like going to be my rocket ship to stardom and early retirement. Obviously, I'm still working, so it didn't work out quite well because Y2K didn't turn into what we thought it would be because, by and large, we rallied around and we fixed the problem. And there, that's something I still have people ask me, well, why don't we fix cybersecurity? And it's because Y2K was a glitch in the code. It was a problem. Cybersecurity is, it's human beings fighting, attacking, it's war. It can't be fixed like that. But anyway, that's what got me into cyber and tech law. And so as a young attorney, I adapted and got into, back then, internet contracting. Could you even have a contract over the internet? Could you do a lot of the things we take for granted today? Back then, we didn't know the answers to that. And so that got me into the cyber, the tech law. That kind of went away with the passage of some legislation. And then I got into the computer hacking, the cybercrime type of law in the early 2000s, mid 2000s. And interestingly enough, that's what led to my work doing cyber privacy data breach work, which today really is 100% of my practice is dealing with cyber privacy issues. But as a young attorney, there wasn't that much work in that area. So I had to work as a business litigator to kind of pay the bills as my day job. And I was at a law firm that did a lot of banking work. So I did a whole lot of banking litigation and, you know, through my career. But the really interesting point is my very first data breach privacy type of matter was in 2001, and it was a banking matter because we were doing a foreclosure for a bank over a healthcare practice that had patient data files everywhere. And so the order I was given from my senior attorneys was, we'll just do a normal foreclosure. And in a normal foreclosure, you come in, you have the sheriff's department take everything out of the building, set it out on the street, and then whatever happens to it, happens to it. I was like, I don't think we can do that, you know, but we were just starting to understand the value of information back then. And so we went through this extensive process of learning how to handle patient medical records, the narcotics, the drugs, everything that was going to be put out on the street. And that was really my first cyber data privacy type of a matter, was a banking foreclosure matter way back then.
Oh my gosh, that's wild. So what did you end up doing with all of those files and information? How did that play out?
So we had a very upset client, which means I had a very upset senior partner, because we had to delay things. We had to go and I was able to convince them we had to follow a proper protocol. We went to the Texas Medical Board, went to the Texas AG's office, spent a lot of time talking with them, figuring out how to have this done. And what we were able to do was ultimately get the sheriff's department to confiscate the drugs. And then for the patient records, we were able to obtain a secure method of having them removed and destroyed and certified, so that we couldn't then be liable if someone came back and said, we've looked at sensitive information. So it delayed the situation. It cost more money for the. They were not happy. But, you know, these days we see now the importance of handling things.
Yeah. So that was the beginning. So, which is insane to think about. And especially even just paper files, those are going by the wayside too. So, yeah. Take me to today. What kind of cases do you work today and what kind of trends do you see?
So today, the firm I'm at, we do a lot of banking work. Spencer Fain, one of our key pillars is banking, you know, been banking clients. And so my team, the cyber and privacy group, does a good bit of work with banks, unfortunately, on the incident response side. So, you know, computer hacking, data theft, cyber intrusions, all of that sort of stuff. So I'm what most of my practice these days is what's called like a breach quarterback, or think of a breach first responder. So, or an incident first responder. You have something adverse happen within your network that's of some significance, not just normal routine incidents. We come in and we help lead the process for investigating that event, and then for how you appropriately remediate it and respond it. And of course, that requires bringing in a team of technical experts and doing it very quickly. Many times I get a call at, let's say, 10 o'clock today, and then we need to have a call with all the team by 11 o'clock to start working on this. And many times they don't even know who the team's going to be yet. So logistics and preparation is a real big part of that. But we advise on the legal side. Obviously, we're lawyers, but we're also in a role more of advisors, like advisory services as well. And so we're not just focusing on the law. We're focusing on the process, making sure everything's done properly, making sure we know what our legal and regulatory obligations are. You know, for banks, you have a very short time period to notify the banking regulators, you know, and those are for incidents that may impact how you can service your customers. But then we also have the cyber and the privacy laws that are applicable to all organizations, your data breach notification laws. So we have to make sure everything we're doing has that in process in mind, so we're not messing stuff up along the way. And so much of my practice is focused on guiding banks through that process and helping to hopefully make sure the matters don't become really big and really problematic, and that you know, the the best work I do is when nobody knows about it. And that's how we try to keep it. And so that's the response side. Then, you know, the other major part of my practice is proactive risk management. And so it's taking the real world practical lessons we learn from the incident response process of what's really happening in the real world, not this theoretical stuff you hear about in, you know, or it's not always, you know, your TV spying on you and that kind of like real world stuff. And we try to help prioritize and focus on those things and make sure that our clients accurately understand what their risk is going to be. And then we help them prioritize how to mitigate that, plan for it. And a big part of that's planning for an incident, incident response preparation and things like that. And then we do testing, you know, the training, the tabletops. And the way I do it is much different than how a lot of folks do it, because I try to simulate what it's really like when we have it happen, not just have a bunch of questions on a WebEx or something like that. Like I want them to feel, because when you feel what it's like to be there in the hot seat going, oh my goodness, we may have to notify all of our customers of something like this, it really hits home. And then you really think about it. And then you think, all right, what can we do to keep this from ever happening? Let's really get serious about it.
Yeah. What you said about being kind of the first responder there, that really resonated with me. I love that analogy. I'm actually in the middle of first aid training right now on, you know, in my personal life. So hearing that makes a lot of sense, right? You have the biggest chance of saving the life or stopping the damage.
You really do, Ashton. And something that's important, that's a great, you know, way to look at this, because speed and quickness and logistics and preparation, having the tools you need, having the ability to react quickly, you know, you may not be the best whatever in the world at stopping that artery from bleeding, but you're the only one there that time. So you got to do the best you can with what you have. And a lot, I mean, no situation is ideal. You never have all the resources you need, you know, but you've got to be able to prioritize very quickly what must be done and execute on that very quickly. And it's exactly how it is in this.
Yeah. So I imagine that probably anyway, folks aren't calling you for, I don't know what I would call maybe like a small breach, right? So how bad does it have to be before you get called in?
So that is a great question, because it doesn't have to be bad at all. It can be something very minor that seems very minor on the surface. And if it's not handled appropriately, it can become a very big thing quickly. For example, in my world, we think about ransomware attacks a lot. That's on the news a lot, where you have organizations getting shut down. Now look, banks typically have really good security. We work with a lot of small and mid-sized banks, and even your small and mid-sized banks typically have better security than your normal small to mid-sized business, right? So they're doing a pretty good job, and that's a something to commend the whole industry on. But we do see ransomware attacks happen on banks. It may not be their whole network. It may not be all of their services, but it doesn't really have to be. You know, it could just be a certain server that disrupts their ability to take care of their customers, and that can create major problems. So we see things like ransomware attacks, right? And we deal with those. But we also see things like access to an email account. We have been working on one matter for a client that involved a simple access to one of the personal banker's email accounts that sent out spam messages for like a very short window of time before it was caught and stopped, which the reaction was great. The stopping was great. It was a very unique flaw that the threat actor took advantage of. But because of that email account being accessed by someone without authorization, that meant the threat actor now had privy to the information in the account, okay? And share files and everything else connected to that. Well, within a personal banker's email account, you have their customers' sensitive information. You may have tax returns. You may have financial account data, all this kind of stuff. Unfortunately, most have spreadsheets of data that have a lot of individuals. Well, now you have to go in, find out what happened. Did the threat actor access this particular data? And if you're not prepared for this in the front end, you may not be able to determine that, which means you now have to notify everybody whose data could have been impacted in there. Well, how do you figure that out? You got to spend a lot of time and money to data mine that account, then put the list together, then send out the notices. And when you do that, the plaintiff's lawyers are just salivating, because who doesn't love to sue a bank, right? That's right. The plaintiff's lawyer's dreams. So we assist with things from very large incidents down to very minor like that, you know, misplaced data, misplaced thumb drives, laptops stolen out of the back of the car at the kid's soccer game when they're not encrypted, all of that. So yeah, it covers the full gamut.
Yeah, my blood pressure rose hearing about some of these. Were stressing me out a little bit.
It really does. And that's part of what we try to teach on the proactive side. Everybody knows now to prepare for a ransomware attack. But do you know to audit your Outlook email and how to properly secure it and to be able to come in and have the tools in place to do that investigation to maybe say, you know what? They didn't get all the data in the email account. They got three files. Well, now we can notify those three people, protect them, and not have to blast out a notice to 5,000-10,000 people for no reason.
Sure.
Yeah.
So let's talk then about that proactive risk management. And you've mentioned tabletop training. So what is tabletop training?
Excuse me. So tabletop training is a nice, expensive sounding word that just really describes practicing by understanding your roles. So you want to start by having an incident response plan. And there, in my view, there are two types of incident response plans. There's the one that the regulators and the boards of directors and the insurance carriers want to see. It's like this binder with a table of contents and tabs and all that, right? I can't think of one case where I've ever asked for one of those in the real world. The other is what I would call the most essential thing. Like, I have a form that I've created, and it's called a quick reaction sheet. That's where we focus on the logistics. Who are we going to need? How are we going to reach them? What's their key role going to be, right? That's something we want our clients to have, because the part of putting that together means you're thinking through this scenario and what you're going to do when it happens. And then you're documenting it so you have it. Kind of like the coach on the sidelines. They don't have the playbook with the binder. They have that one sheet, you know, that they're calling play off of. That's where we want to get from a preparation standpoint. We want to take all that mess, refine it down to the most essential things, and be ready to use that. Then we want to get our key people in the room. We want to get our executives. We want our CEO in there. We want our CFO. We want our all of our technical leadership. And sometimes we maybe even get in the whole technical team on certain phases. And we want to talk about what are our real world likely risks going to be. We want to make sure everybody around that table understands their role. And we want to make sure we have people, you know, who can step in if they're not available. And so we understand the process. Then we go through some real world scenarios and say, if this happened, who does what? Who makes the first call? Who leads this team? How, you know, who do we dial first? When do we bring in law enforcement? How do we even contact them? Do we have our personal relationships established? Do we have our vendors established who are going to come in and work with us on the technical side of that investigation? Do we know who our banking regulators are? Is it just one person that has that contact, or do we have multiple people in case that one person's out so we can make our appropriate notifications? All of these kind of things go into planning for a real world incident, and we want to test it and we want to practice it. And so that's what a tabletop is. It's where we get around the table, we're all looking each other in the eye, and we're talking and having a conversation. And when we do that, you see such magic come from that, because people start sharing concerns and issues they've had and worried about that don't get talked about on a Zoom, and certainly not through an email. But through that, you start learning of your risks that you really haven't thought about. And now, through our practicing for responding to an incident, we're actually safeguarding and better preparing ourselves so that we never get there. And so there's so much magic that comes out of that process, but it's really getting your key people together in a room together with a whiteboard and talking about where you are, where you're going, what you're going to do along the way, and learning. And it's that collaboration that's the magic.
Yeah, and I guess that, to your point, if you've got a practice and a one-page guide compared to your binder, you can be really nimble in the event that something were to happen.
That's exactly right, because, you know, the saying, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Or as Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan till they get punched in the nose, right? You know your plan. Your enemy doesn't know your plan. They're not going to follow. Being nimble and agile like that is really the key to adapting.
Perfect. So tell me, if I feel like you've given a lot of tips and advice for our listeners already today. I know I've got some great takeaways, but if you could pick one thing to tell our listeners, what would that be?
I would say you have to understand your practical real-world risks, and you have to put into place the logistics of how you're going to respond to something like that happening, and not suffer from paralysis by analysis. By trying to solve every problem, focus on the most important ones and start there and work your way down.
Perfect. I love it. Yeah, don't get lost in the forest, right? It's awesome.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Sean, thanks for joining me today. This has been really enlightening, and I love hearing how passionate about it you are.
Well, thank you very much, Ashton. I appreciate you having me, and I'm always happy to join you anytime you want to talk about any of these fun issues.
Love it. Thank you.
All right.
And for the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.